Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It's Aloha Friday, March 15th. Today we have an Oahu History Hanaho show. We're resharing some of our recent interviews about various historical places on the island. We'll take you to Makapu'u Lighthouse, where we'll talk to the last lighthouse keeper, then out to Pearl Harbor to reflect on the Bowfin submarine's place in naval history. We'll also look at the connection that a group of World War II-era Okinawan women have to our islands. Plus, we'll highlight Palama Settlement's contributions to children in our community over the years. And a local actor channels the spirit of a long-gone botanist to tell the story of Foster Botanical Garden's origins. You're listening to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today we're reaching back into our recent history to bring you an Oahu History Hanaho show. We're revisiting some of our favorite interviews about significant places or moments in Oahu's storied past. And we start with Makapu'u Lighthouse. This year marks 50 years since it became automated. Ron Chanfarani was the final lighthouse keeper back when it was under the jurisdiction of the U.S. Coast Guard. He returned to Hawaii recently and was given a VIP tour of the lighthouse, honoring his service and his part in lighthouse history. The retired Coast Guard petty officer now lives in Rhode Island and recalled getting the plum assignment here in the islands.
Well, when I received my orders, it said 14th Coast Guard District, which is Hawaii, tentative assignment officer in charge of Makapu'u Point Light Station. And I had never been stationed at a light station before. I had no clue. I really didn't know a heck of a lot about Hawaii, except it was beautiful. So I contacted the officer in charge of the station, and he sent me some photos, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, the place was absolutely gorgeous. So I was overseas at the time, so I sent the photos to my wife. She was very excited. We ended up going there. It was an unbelievable 3 years. It was pretty isolated. I had two children while we were there, twin girls and a son. And the girls don't remember any of it because they were born there. My son was about around five, so he remembers a little bit of it, and he's been actually back there. We had a great time. We used to go down to the tide pools, which is about halfway down that road. We could park along the side and hike down. I used to have to carry him up because he was pretty young. But we used to swim in the tide pools. There's a huge blowhole down there. I believe it's illegal to go down there now.
Yes, too dangerous.
Yeah, it's too dangerous of a walk. But we used to do it.
Well, now, did you actually live there?
There were three homes there. Two of them with three bedrooms, and one was a two-bedroom. So I had two other gentlemen living there with their families.
Wow.
And we maintained the light, obviously, kept the grounds in beautiful shape, had an office, a garage, an emergency generator room in case the light did go out. Believe it or not, we got our water from a pump down at Sea Life Park. It would be pumped up to the top of the hill, gravity down to a... It was probably a 2,000-3,000-gallon water tank, and then gravitated right into our homes. It was kind of interesting.
Well, now, did the light at the lighthouse ever go out?
No, it never went out. We had it's called the lamp changer, which had two bulbs on it, 2,000-watt bulbs. And if one of the bulbs went out, it would automatically replace it with the other bulb. So we never had a problem with that. Not in the 3 years I was there.
So what was that like, I mean, knowing that you were really the beacon of hope for mariners out there on the water?
Kind of took it for granted, really. I mean, it was just so nice up there. Uniform of the day, shorts and flip-flops. it was private back then.
Yes.
We had a gate at the bottom of the hill. There was no parking lot for tourists. We had a little gate shack down there where if any of our friends wanted to visit, we had a crank phone down there, and it would ring up to the three homes, and whoever was on duty would answer the phone to find out if someone was coming down. Because if someone was coming down, you weren't going to go up at the same time. As you know, that road is narrow.
Well, now, you have since returned to Hawaii to visit the lighthouse, but this particular trip marked 50 years since you were last manning the facility. And, you know, the Department of Land and Natural Resources has put in quite a penny to improve access to that area. What did you think about that?
They sure did. I was highly impressed. It's really great for tourists now. The road has improved probably 100%. I know you can't drive up there, but that was our mode of transportation. We drove up that hill every day, probably. I think I could do it blindfolded.
Yeah, but it was a sketchy trail.
It was sketchy, yeah. But, you know, we got used to it. I mean, we had to take the kids to preschool, my son, every day. We had to go to Waimanalo for the mail and obviously shopping. So we, you know, even the girls, they drove it all the time. You know, the wives. It was quite the experience.
And so what was it like going up there this past trip? You know, did you see a lot of whales?
Oh, yeah, we saw a lot of whales. The Coast Guard Base Sand Island, the 8th Navigation Team, there's six gentlemen on that team. They were unbelievable. They took us up in a van. They took photos and everything. And, I mean, they treated us like royalty. It was just a great time. We went right down to the lighthouse, inside the light, inside the lens. Oh, and by the way, that lens is the second largest lens in the world.
Really?
It's the first largest lens in the United States. It was hand-cut and polished in 1887 in France. It was featured in the, I believe, the 1904 World's Fair in Chicago. And then the United States bought it, and they erected it in 1909. And believe it or not, that road wasn't there then. They scaled everything up the side of that cliff.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's hard to believe. But that's how it was erected, everything up that side of that cliff.
And while you were here in Hawaii, you also had to go and visit some of the other lighthouses across the state.
Yes, when they automated the light station, I was transferred to the 8th Navigation Team. And we serviced all the lighthouses and shore structures in Hawaii and all the islands. So I got to see just about every part of every island there was. Actually, Molokini, I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Yes.
That little teeny island, they used to lower us in a helicopter. We have a light structure on the very top of that. They would lower us in a helicopter to service that light. That was one interesting spot. Another interesting place was Kalapapa, the leper colony. We used to go there and spend one or two nights servicing that light. That was very interesting. On Lanai, we would rent four-wheel drive vehicles and go to areas on Lanai that probably nobody's ever been to, or very, very few. And that was like that on all the islands. Most of your shore structures are in crazy places that you really can't get to.
And you were also on Kauai?
Oh, yeah. I was on Kauai many times. I was on every island. I spent 3 years on the 8th Navigation Team. Oh, roughly every 6 months, we would service all the islands. And if something was wrong, we had a big problem with vandals, shooting out lights, stuff like that, just destroying them. So we'd get emergency calls. We'd have to go out and service lights. So, yeah, I traveled a lot on all the islands.
Is there a fun fact about any of the lighthouses that you recalled that you'd like to share with our listeners?
A fun fact?
Yeah.
I think the most fun was going to Lanai because we had some really out-of-the-way places. They gave us money for food and hotels, but to save money back then, we would bring a tent, cooking utensils, little grill, and we would tent out on the beaches. Like I said, very isolated, nobody around. I think that was one of the fun things we really enjoyed. Same way on Molokai, we had lights where we would have to see the owner of the ranch get keys to their gates to get to our lights. And we would do the same thing there.
But I can imagine, you know, kind of the wilderness, rugged, remote, beautiful.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Other than that, we had a lot of great times traveling. On Lanai, we'd get out of the pineapple docks. They would load us up with pineapples. I mean, we'd come back and we had pineapples for the entire neighborhood. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun.
That was Ron Chanfarani, the final lighthouse keeper in Hawaii. Makapu Lighthouse was the last to be automated. He lived in housing at the facility with his young family. He has fond memories of life at the lighthouse, including the delivery of a bouquet of flowers for his wife from Hawaii Five-O actor Jack Lord. The TV star sent them after filming for the series Block the Road to the Lighthouse for a time. It had delayed the couple bringing home one of their twins from the hospital. Chanfarani saved newspaper clippings and photos and was grateful to revisit the lighthouse after 5 decades of working there. Her name is the Pearl Harbor Avenger, and she's docked at Pearl Harbor. She is the USS Bofin, a World War II submarine put in service over 8 years ago. Out of the 200 submarines built in her class, only 15 remain in the world. We talked to Chuck Merkel, executive director of the Pacific Lead Submarine Museum, about the Bofin's place in naval history, both in real life and on the big screen.
She remains a memorial to the 52 submarines lost and the over 3,600 submariners that died during World War II. The Bofin herself, she was launched on December 7th, 1942 at Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. So she was given the nickname the Pearl Harbor Avenger. And as was customary during the war, submarines were named after fish or aquatic animals. So it's kind of interesting. The Bofin was named for a brackish water fish native to North America, and it dates back to the Jurassic period. So it could say that the Bofin fish is a survivor, and it's known to be a very aggressive predator, known to creep into the shallow waters at night and conduct ambush attacks on its prey. So pretty appropriate name for a submarine. When we found ourselves in World War II, we had a pretty ideal submarine to go out and do the things that Bofin and her sister ships did.
Well, explain to our listeners exactly what the USS Bofin is credited with doing.
She was commissioned on the 1st of May, 1943, and as soon as she was ready, she left the east coast of the United States and made the transit to Australia. And that in and of itself is a pretty amazing voyage. Probably most of the sailors on board had never made any kind of extended voyage up until that point. And then she made the first of her 5 war patrols out of Australia. After about a year of time, all of our submarines needed some major repairs and work to be done. So she came back to the West Coast United States and had repairs and some modernization done. And she came out of the yards and did her final 4 war patrols out of Pearl Harbor and Guam. She made a total of 9 war patrols, claimed to have sunk 44 enemy vessels during the course of those patrols. She also did some special, what we called special operations, and during World War II, that meant probably laying some mines, also to resupply guerrillas in the Philippines, and possibly to insert or extract guerrillas if they needed to be brought out or to bring in replacements. She did a number of those things. She was awarded the Presidential Unit Citation, which is the highest level of unit award given to a ship or aircraft squadron in our Navy. Also awarded a Navy Unit Commendation, and she was awarded the Philippine Presidential Unit Citation.
Well, these submarines, they're pretty stealthy, right? I mean, they just kind of sneak up on you, and they can do some damage, and they did, which helped change the course of the war.
Absolutely. I think most people today think in terms of a submarine as always being underwater, which our modern submarines, being nuclear-powered, have that capability to do so. But during World War II, although they were state-of-art, our submarines really needed to be thought of as small surface ships that could submerge for brief periods of time. And she was most effectively employed when she spent most of her time on the surface. She could maximize her height of eye to the horizon, so she could maximize her search distance. She could use her radars to their full capability, and then only to submerge if felt threatened or to execute an attack.
she's been tied up there at Pearl Harbor for some time now, and you folks were able to officially get it declared as a National Historic Landmark.
She was decommissioned in 1947, got recommissioned in 1951 for the Korean War, and then in 1954, she was decommissioned a final time. She was out at Mare Island Naval Shipyard. She spent the 60s up in Seattle at Lake Union. She was a reserve training ship. And then in the early 70s, she was towed out here to be actually scrapped. Then through the efforts of the Navy League, and of course we had Senator Inouye and lots of people doing some push-ups, we were able to stand up the association I now run. And in 1979, the Bowfin was donated to the association. After sitting over at the inactive ships facility here in Hawaii, she was in pretty rough shape. She was down in Honolulu Harbor for about a year and a half, and then in April of 81, she was brought here to where she is today and open to the public. And in 1986, she got dry docked, and that was in preparation for the filming of the War and Remembrance. She was actually out on the Waianae coast for filming that miniseries. We did another dry docking in 2004, and then just this last fall, we finished another makeover. Mainly, we're worried about the maintaining the watertight integrity of the hull and keeping her safe and suitable for a public display, and we really think we're in great shape. I think the next time we'll put her in dry dock will be in about the 2040 time frame, just prior to her 100th birthday.
Wow. That's amazing. You know, and you have so many people that stop over there as part of the tour at Pearl Harbor and Arizona Memorial. What strikes you, you know, about the folks that come to visit and what they take away when they hear her history and the stories of the sailors who served on her?
I think everybody comes on board. I think there's a realization of how small the space is inside the submarine. Each sailor has very little personal space, and just how cramped everything is. It really took teamwork to operate the ship, to take it to sea, to take it on a war patrol, to execute the attacks, and then to come home safely. Every crew member had to do their job to the best of their abilities. And it really is a team effort. And that's true today on our modern submarines. They're certainly more technology advanced. They have the nuclear propulsion capability. But without the crew members on board to bring that ship to life, it's really meaningless.
And so what would you like listeners to remember about the Bowfin as we mark the 80th anniversary?
I think that she's a survivor. She survived the war. None of her crew members were hurt. She's been serving our nation for 80 years, first as the active duty warship, then as a reserve training ship, and now for 42 years, she's been a museum ship. For many people, it's the first, possibly only time they're ever on a submarine.
And then do you have a personal story or a connection to the Bowfin?
Not necessarily to the Bowfin herself, but I served in our submarine force for 30 years. I was fortunate that I served on four Pearl Harbor-based submarines during my time in the Navy. It's not very often that a job like this opens up, and to be given the opportunity to maintain this ship as a memorial and to operate and maintain this museum. And we have done a $20 million makeover of our museum over the last few years. So it's been it's a labor of love. There were a lot of challenges, you know, executing that sort of a renovation, but throw in the additional complications from the COVID pandemic, and to have made the improvements here and in our facilities and to keep the ship safe and suitable for the public. Very proud of those accomplishments.
Yeah, you know, and I think as we mark these, you know, anniversaries, right, at Pearl Harbor, we've got Armistice Day coming up as well later this summer. I mean, all just part of the history of the Pacific.
You know, there won't be any other submarines available to be open to the public like the Bowfin, our nuclear-powered submarines. We've maintained one, the Nautilus, that's in Groton, Connecticut. There won't be any other submarines available to put on public display. So we've got a maintain the ones that are currently out there in good condition and keep them available to the public for as long as we possibly can.
That was Chuck Merkel, Executive Director of the Pacific Fleet Submarine Museum, talking about the USS Bowfin, a World War II submarine that marked its 80th anniversary of being put into service last year. Merkel notes the number of submarines is dwindling. Back in the day, there was a fleet of 41 ballistic subs. It is now down to 14. And of the 100 attack subs, there are about 50 left. Merkel himself served on four submarines based at Pearl Harbor, and his last active duty assignment was with Submarine Forces, U.S. Pacific Fleet. A recent exhibit at the University of Hawaii West Oahu campus hoped to promote peace by reminding us of the atrocities of war. It was entitled Himeyuri and Hawaii. It focused on a group of Okinawan women memorialized on the island after the sacrifices they made during World War II. It also highlighted their connection to our islands. The Conversation's Russell Subiono spoke to retired UH professor Joyce Chinnan about the exhibit.
If anyone understands the relationship between the island of Okinawa, which sits off the coast of Japan, and Hawaii, it's Joyce Chinnan. In addition to being a retired sociology professor, she's also the former director of the University of Hawaii's Center for Okinawan Studies. Japanese immigrants first came to Hawaii in 1885, but Okinawans didn't arrive in our islands until 15 years later, in 1900, as part of a later wave of Japanese looking for better life opportunities.
Because of Okinawa's history, the Ryukyu Islands' history with Hondo, mainland Japan, Okinawans were kind of discouraged or were prevented from being part of the immigration labor. So it wasn't until 1899 that Toyama Kyuzo was considered the father of Okinawan immigration, was able to secure permission to recruit Okinawans to come to Hawaii to work on the sugar plantations.
But the exhibit at UH West Oahu isn't about the history of Okinawan immigrants working on sugar or pineapple plantations or laying down roots in Hawaii. It tells a much darker story, one that took a horrific turn in the closing days of World War II on the island of Okinawa.
The 1945 Battle of Okinawa left 200,000 dead, including some 94,000 Okinawan civilians. These include local schoolgirls who were forced to serve at the front line as nurses, known as the Himeyuri Student Corps.
If you've never heard of the Himeyuri, it's okay. Most people haven't. There is information about them on the internet, but it's limited, and most of it is in Japanese. This is the gist of it. A total of 222 female students and 18 teachers attended the Okinawa Daiichi Women's High School and the Okinawa Shihan Women's School in 1945. They were just your average young women getting a good education until the Japanese Imperial Army turned them into a nursing unit to support the war, which by 1945 was getting increasingly difficult for Japan.
Okinawa to meet the Japs. We can see the yellow smoke of the gunfire above the battleships. We are passing transports over our starboard and over our port as we plow ahead.
They were generally like junior high to high school students in the lead up to the war. There was a whole push by the militarism in Japan to prepare people for Okinawa as well as mainland Japan for the war effort. And so the boys became known as the Blood and Iron Corps, who were carrying munitions, running lines, communication lines, and so on, for the Japanese military. And then the girls were made into nurses, nursing support people.
Over 200 young women forced into the war effort as nurses with little to no medical training. Many of them tended to wounded and dying Japanese soldiers in makeshift hospitals in caves. Imagine being a young woman in 1945 in Okinawa, excited about getting an education with hopes of becoming a teacher one day. Then your country tells you your job is now a temporary assignment to care for broken and bloodied young soldiers. Maybe one of the reasons this story isn't more widely known is because 136 of the 222 Himeyuri women were killed during the three-month Battle of Okinawa. Many others killed themselves by taking cyanide or using hand grenades or jumping off jagged cliffs near the Arasaki seashore. Chinen says it took the feminist movement in the 1960s to open the door for more war stories about women to be told.
As a child growing up, many of us, particularly those of us who are in our 60s, 70s, and so on, we heard about the Himeyuri. They were kind of spoken about, but in the actual kind of historical materials, generally, you know, well, until very recently, so the second wave of feminism, we don't have a whole lot of things on women's history. So Himeyuri, people knew about informally, but there wasn't a whole lot of research on it. So this is significant in the sense that it's focusing on the interrelationship between Hawaii and Okinawa, but through the lens of the Himeyuri.
The lives sacrificed by the Himeyuri are memorialized at the Himeyuri Peace Museum in Okinawa. Among the items on display are portraits of all the young women who died and the testimonials of the survivors. Some of the same visuals and information being shared at the Himeyuri and Hawaii exhibit at UH West Oahu, a project that took over 4 years to complete.
What we have are photographs of the artifacts that are in the museum. So you have to actually go to the museum to see the actual artifacts. But, you know, combs and little personal objects that the girls carried. You know, we have photographs of those things, fountain pens and simple things like that. So we have photographs of those things. And these are panels that are kind of set up. They're nicely traveling panels. So they're lightweight. They can be rolled up. It's really remarkable how we were able to get these.
The Himeyuri Peace Museum in Okinawa is dedicated to peace and uses images and stories of the Himeyuri to remind visitors of the horrors of war. The Himeyuri and Hawaii exhibit at UH West Oahu hopes to accomplish the same goal, but also examines the relationship between the Himeyuri and our islands. For example, one of the instructors at the schools the Himeyuri girls attended before the war was born in Hawaii and traveled back to Okinawa to teach. And at least one of the Himeyuri survivors is known to have married a man from Hawaii and spent the remainder of her days here. Chinen says the exhibit is also a reminder that peace starts on an individual level.
I think it's important to underscore the kind of individual acts of kindness and generosity, but also a realization that it's so easy to slip into wartime hysteria, and we really need to work on consciously promoting peace. And one of the ways to do that, I think, is educational interchanges. So I think those kinds of person-to-person relationships, we need to do those, more of those kinds of things beyond just the kind of international, you know, nation-to-nation kinds of negotiations and exchanges. I mean, we have to do those too, but in addition to that, otherwise it's so easy to get sucked into the fog of war, the language of preparing for war and, you know, getting hooked into that.
That was retired University of Hawaii professor Joyce Chin and talking with HPR's Russell Subiono. You are listening to our Oahu History Hanaho Show, and we'll be right back after a short break.
Support for HPR comes from the Kim Koko Fund for Justice of the Iwamoto Family Foundation, committed to a sustainable economy, supporting toxin-free food producers, arts education, and programs that develop creative, problem-solving leaders.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hello, I'm Omkari Williams, author of Microactivism. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about how small, consistent actions can make a big impact.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for the conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, Bavarian Motor Experts, and Chaminade University.
Welcome back to our Oahu History Hanaho Show. We're revisiting some of our recent interviews about significant places on Oahu. Last September, Palama Settlement opened its doors for an event to celebrate its history and the people who helped to make it a safe place for children to dream and to help a community grow strong and thrive. That's how it was for NFL football player Chris Maafala and his siblings. Take a listen.
My two older siblings, even though they were outstanding, athletes, they kind of had to hide and do it behind my parents' back. But when my dad, you know, at his job, people would come up and like, hey, do you know these kids? They have your last name, and they're on a paper, front of the paper. So that was our introduction to Palama Settlement and sports.
The NFL player was on hand last year for the event. And like Maafala, Paula Rath has deep roots in the neighborhood. It's her family legacy that she has worked tirelessly to continue. We talked to her last September about the celebration for Palama Settlement.
It's called Reflections of Palama. And we interviewed 16 people who we call narrators. I've been a journalist in the past, but I was trained to do the oral histories by the Center for Oral History. So it's a partnership of the three organizations. And it's just been such an education for all of us. We chose people ages 41 to 95. We chose people who represent former staff, athletes, artists, board members, teachers, coaches, program administrators, and of course, Brother Noland, who is very famous around Palama circles, having worked with us for decades in different capacities. So they also represented many different nationalities, Samoan, Hawaiian, Scots, Filipino, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, and Mel Kanashige, who describes himself as Hapa, Okinawan, and Japanese, and is happy to explain that. So the project definitely brings a lot of heart, because that's what Palama's all about.
And the folks that are taking part in this, I mean, they all got their start here at Palama Settlement?
Well, some of them got their start here, and some of them became board members in later years, but they all have a close connection, and they were selected for that reason.
And this is a passion project for you because of your ties to Paloma Settlement.
Yes. My grandparents were the founders, James Arthur and Rania Helsher Rath. And my father was born and raised here and literally grew up as a barefoot Paloma boy. And my mother spent over 10 years creating the Paloma Archives. So I kind of grew up here too in a lot of ways.
I mean, it's a lovely facility for folks who have not been here. You know, there's a lovely pool. You've got all these activities for the kids. You've got digital classes for adults. I mean, I just was amazed just being in your lobby, seeing, you know, what you offer to the community.
And we've got kids in there learning anime right now. And we've got pickleball players. We have, and our gym is big enough for 5 pickleball courts indoors and 2 outdoors. And we've introduced water polo recently in our pool. So yes, we've got a lot of really great things going on at Paloma Settlement.
And I guess, you know, since you've just come off of a big anniversary, you know, for the settlement, you know, I mean,
25 years.
And so you have, as part of the research, you know, for this anniversary, you have been able to pull together all the archives, and you've got boxes of rich history that detail stories of the settlement.
Yes, we do. And the oral histories add a great deal. Our first oral histories were done for the centennial, which was 1996. And there were 29 of them. And of those, more than half of the people who were narrators at that time have passed away. So we really, 125 years was a wake-up call. It's time to do it again. It's another generation. We have a fabulous, extremely qualified archivist, Sidney Louie, who is in the midst of a digitization project. My mother's work was just the beginning, and her work actually went through 1980. And now we have from 1980 to 2023, which is in Sydney's lap. So we have volunteers assisting with that. We have some of our scholarship students who receive Paloma scholarships also helping out. And we are really gathering resources to have our archives digitized. Now, the oral histories will be available through a program called Scholar Space, which you access through the University of Hawaii. And our oral histories, the recordings, and the transcripts will both be available. By the end of the year, all 16 will be available. A lot of great surprises came up. When you're doing an oral history, it can go in a lot of different directions. And some of them are surprising, but all of them are interesting. And when you get people talking about their small kid time, and they talk about, oh, you know, when I was a paper boy in Palolo, and when I was playing ukulele on the steps at Pua Lane, and when I was swimming or getting my teeth fixed or going to canteen dances at Paloma. And we have some just wonderful voices that are coming through these oral histories.
And it's so important. You had shared that someone mentioned where they were and what they were doing
on December 7th. Yes. Epi Kerr, who is now 95, remembers being a little girl boarding at Punahou on December 7th, 1941. And she has some very vivid memories. But one of them is that they did not get breakfast the next morning because the Army got their breakfast first. And so the girls learned they had to get up earlier in the morning, before 6, to get their breakfast. And Albert Wong, who's 92, was told where his father was on December 7th. His father was with Mr. Ai, the person who started City Mill, and the two of them were working on bundling things for the poor, and they heard noises on the tin roof, and they were baffled, and they went outside, and there was shrapnel falling on the city mill roof. So there are all these really interesting and so many fascinating cultural stories that come out. Karisma Afala, who is the youngest of 11 children, talked a great deal about it, what it meant to be a child living in the projects and then be discovered because he played football at Palama Settlement. And St. Louis recognized his abilities and he went on to the NFL. And Tupu Alu Alu talked about what chiefdom means to Samoan people. There were picture brides talked about by many people. They are absolutely wonderful stories, and they are all connected with Palama Settlement.
That was Paula Rath, whose family planted the seed for a community center that has flourished over more than a century in our Hawaiʻi. At last September celebration of Palama Settlement, festivities highlighted oral histories of its rich past and the many hands who helped build the foundation of a thriving, diverse neighborhood. And there's gratitude from many who have built successful careers around their passion, including musician Brother Nolan. His hit, Pualain, is a nod to the hard-knock life in the projects and the power of making dreams come true, thanks to places like Palama Settlement.
Bye, 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 Pualain. Yes, tears always fall from my eyes. I said bye bye Pualain, so long Pualain. Oh dear God, I hope that all my friends don't shatter their dreams.
Like many of us in our Honolulu, you may pass by Foster Botanical Gardens on your daily commute into town or regularly visit Queens Medical Center. But you may not fully appreciate the connection between the two downtown sites. Well, last year, among the exceptional trees at the City Botanical Garden, folks were treated to the backstory, or like arborists like to say, the understory. For the play, The Beginnings of a Garden, local thespian Craig Howes brought to life the character of botanist and Queens physician William Hillebrand. And it was Hillebrand whom we talked with in our studio last November.
Good afternoon, my friends, or aloha, as we say here in Hawaii. I am so happy to see such an interest in my garden, and surprised that many of you have expressed an interest in my life as well, and how I came to be the owner of this tropical paradise so far away from the land of my birth. It is hard to believe that I have passed 20 years in these lovely islands, and that now, in this year of 1871, I am preparing to depart for my homeland. I cannot remember a time when I did not love plants, trees, and everything about the natural world that we live in. I was born in Prussia in 1821, in the small town of Neheim, Westphalia. My father was a respected judge in the court of the nearby city of Paderborn, and it seems that my parents, who had buried two daughters in the Neheim graveyard, vowed on the day I was born that I would become a physician. I had a very happy childhood, roaming through the fields and forests that surrounded our little town with my three younger brothers. We would catch tadpoles or collect watercress. And on clear days, we would climb the old watchtower that looked out toward the ancient and mysterious Teutoburger Forest, where we would dream about adventures in faraway lands.
And Dr. Hillebrand, you had quite an adventure here in the islands.
Quite a number, actually. I was able to be a doctor, but also able to entertain my passion for botany.
And as the chief physician at Queens, Queens Medical Center is graced with a number of trees that you brought over to the islands. Tick down a few on the list.
Well, I first should mention that although I am, in fact, the chief physician at Queens, I am also the only physician at Queens. As for the trees, I had those imported and introduced. Have you seen the two bombax specimens there? Their showy pink and white blossoms are a favorite with Queen Emma.
One of my favorites.
The baobab tree is doing very well. There's the kapok and the date palm and the royal palm and the monkey pod tree, which I think is very well suited to our islands. Perhaps the best known of my trees, though, is the frangipani or plumeria, which I introduced 10 years ago.
And many of these trees stand majestic over at Foster Gardens, which is where you used to live?
That was where my wife Anna and I made our home in 1855, and I expanded over the years to contain my, dare I say, magnificent garden.
Your collection?
My collection. Beautiful and useful specimens. That is where I have my magnificent ear pod tree and my tropical almond and kapok as well.
And I happened to be at Foster Gardens a few years ago when there was a coming to life of many characters of your time. Mary Foster, for whom the gardens are named for, and Harold Lyon, who Lyon Arboretum is named for.
Well, I was very familiar with Mary Foster because I ultimately sold our property to the Fosters, her husband Thomas and Mrs. Foster, who had a great love for gardens and plants and all the natural world. I left Hawaii in 1871 and returned to Germany and sadly never returned.
Well, you also worked with the monarchy. You were able to travel, and I think you were responsible for bringing in workers from Portugal.
I was actually assigned by the Hawaiian government to travel for 2 years for three purposes. One was for the importation of laborers. I was responsible for signing up 528 Chinese laborers in Hong Kong, so was involved in the first large migration of Chinese laborers to Hawaii. Much later, I was involved in the arrival of the Portuguese, but by that point I had actually already arrived back in Germany and facilitated it from there. One of my other assignments on the 2-year trip I took to Asia was to bring back useful plants and animals. So among the plants that I brought back at that time were camphor, cinnamon, jackfruit, lychee, eugenias, banyan, mandarin orange, Chinese plum, Java plum, and many, many other plants as well. I also brought back birds and deer.
Well, I thank you because I have some of those trees in my yard. And it's just really interesting to learn about how these plants came to be here in the islands. Did you have any particular favorites?
I was very fond of the flowering plants because they were also useful. I was very happy to encourage the planting of shade trees over the streets of Honolulu. The town was dry and dusty when I first got here. So I was very involved in bringing in the shower trees, the African tulip tree, and the plumeria tree, although not a great shade tree, still was one that has proved to be very, very popular.
Yes, the laymakers love it.
Yes.
And the people who buy lei from the lei sellers, thank you. And so this weekend, you will be among friends under the trees at Foster Botanical Garden.
Yes, I'm very happy to return after a rather long absence.
And so tell us about what visitors to the garden can expect.
First of all, the lovely environment of the garden, which is always a pleasure. But on this particular weekend, through means I don't quite understand, we will actually have in succession the three people who have been most responsible for creating, nurturing, and presenting the garden to the people of Hawaii. I started the garden and then passed that garden on to the Fosters and Mary Foster, who did a remarkable job of maintaining it and eventually deeding it to the city of Honolulu. It was then taken over by Harold Lyon, who did a great job of maintaining the garden and protecting it from development and other ideas that the city might have had in mind for turning it into something very different from what it was. All three of us will be there, and in a relatively short form, tell the stories of our own engagement with the place and Hawaii in general. I would just like to assert, though, that we are not artifacts or museum pieces, but in fact, lively and, I hope, interesting individuals with a great deal of information to share. This is often, I gather, referred to as a living history presentation, which usually means that it is site-specific. The real attraction here is the garden, as it always is. What we are providing is in some ways a kind of historical guided tour of the garden. Those who choose to visit us will be actually standing in the garden. They will be moving from place to place because each of us is standing in one of our favorite spots. So in addition to being a dramatic performance of a kind, it is also, to a degree, a guided tour through the garden. So anybody who attends can anticipate an enjoyable and beautiful time in one of Honolulu's greatest treasures.
All right. Well, Dr. Hillebrand, we certainly appreciate your time with us this morning.
Oh, it has been my pleasure. It is always wonderful to return to Hawaii.
That was part of a conversation we had with William Hillebrand as portrayed by Craig Howes. The Beginning of a Garden is a play among the trees presented by the Friends of Honolulu Botanical Gardens last November. Our friend and contributing editor Neil Milner reprised his role as Harold Lyon. And we leave off with Joni Mitchell, who wrote a song about Hawaii and who has a line about our tree museum at Foster Botanical Garden.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. With a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. And they charged the people a dollar and a half just to see them.
That is it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we'll hear about Pacific Biodiesel's plan to expand to Kauai, a move that could strengthen Hawaii's food security, energy security, and supply chain resiliency. Call our talkback line and leave your comments. That's 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can listen back to our shows on the conversation page on the HPR website. Also, find us on Spotify, Apple, or anywhere else you tune in for podcasts. Our program is produced by Russell Subiano and Lillian Song, with help from Savannah Harriman-Pote and Maddie Bender. The Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. Our theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.